Hello and welcome to The Undermined, a podcast about brute war AI development. My name is Shonko, your host from makingcomputerdothings.com. Let us begin. Hello and welcome to the podcast again. Tonight's guests are Antiga, hello, hello, or Meow.
Hi.
Bruce Nielsen, aka Locutus.
Hello.
And Nightcat. Hello, Nightcat.
Hello.
First of all, I'd like to start with thanks to the Pylon Show. And not just for handling the Antiga issue professionally in the past, but they were kind enough to mention the Undermined podcast on their latest and the episode before that. So thanks for that, and that was done in good faith. And yeah, keep it up. First topic is a little bit different than StarCraft. Actually, Diablo 1. Got re-released on GOG.com, and since we have a resident Diablo AI developer, let's discuss that a little. What does that mean for us? Nightcat, do you have a few words about this?
Yeah, it's interesting to see the response in the Diablo community. I've seen some varied and different responses to this release. There are people that are in the camp of, well, I still have my original CD, so why am I being charged $10 for something? And then there are people that are finding it more bittersweet, because on the one hand, you know, it's making Diablo 1 available to the public again, because there's been no legal way to purchase the game outside of trying eBay and hoping that this $300 CD that you're paying for is not too scratched up to use, or potentially considering the game as abandonware and taking the risk of downloading an ISO or something like that. So it's great that it is making it available again, but at the same time, Blizzard has put out a release on their own website where they have said all future support for the game is now through GOG. So that basically means Blizzard is essentially washing their hands of the game, which dashes any hopes for a remaster a la StarCraft. But given from what I've seen of how that game is coded, I'm not surprised that that's what came of it.
I mean, it's more than 20 years old by now. And it isn't compatible with anything. Well, that is the until the GOG team made it somewhat compatible with current systems. So yeah, it's a mixed bag. But I think it's a great thing that they allowed us to have this. What does that mean for your Diablo API project? Is there any advancements in that field?
So, in terms of the AI project, some people have examined the executable that was released with the GOG release and compared it to the old executable that was the most patched available. And there were only three differences that they found, and those three differences should be insignificant to the AI project. I plan on testing it out this weekend to see and verify that it still is working. However, also based on those edits, it looks like the executable was just hex edited. So the theory is that any changes they make are not going to be that large. And also, GOG, I think, is known for trying to present old games the way they were, essentially, just making it easier to play it on newer systems. So I'm not too afraid of them, say, releasing a patch that's going to break everything and you know, fix all of the bugs that make Diablo so fun.
Is the item duping bug still present?
Yeah, all of the bugs are still there. There are some new bugs that are related more to the compatibility. I mean, essentially what they've done is they've packaged everything that the community was already doing to play the game on newer operating systems in one place. And that's not to say that they just pulled things off the internet, packaged it, and are selling it for $10. They may very well have developed some of the tools themselves, but they're essentially the same thing that the community's been doing.
It was really difficult to play Diablo 1 on a modern operating system without a litany of third-party software in order to get it to operate correctly and messing with files. And what they've done is alleviated a lot of that.
And that's the sweet part of the bittersweet, because now if you want to bug anyone to play Diablo 1 with you, you can just say, go to GOG and get everything you need in one place.
Convenience is always king.
You know, I'm a long-term lover of Diablo 1. I played it even after Diablo 2 was released for years in the legit community, and I have done sort of the high-end PvP tournament stuff with it and all of that. And, you know, I have a tremendous love of the game and so many good experiences and so many great friends in playing it. And I'm just excited to see that, you know, it's sort of a back in a public fashion. You know, the hardcore people like me never really stopped playing it, but it was so complex to get running that it really was in a lot of ways abandoned, which is unfortunate. And so hopefully it'll get a new lease on life now.
One thing I can say is I noticed on Twitch, the viewers watching Diablo streams shot way up the day that GOG released this. I think there was like somewhere between 600 to 300 it was floating around, which is almost unheard of for Diablo 1. And there were so many new people streaming the game, and it's been a lot of fun too to watch new people discovering this old game, watching their first time playing through and dying repeatedly because they've become used to all of the ease of life that like Diablo 3 affords.
Not unlike the parallel with Brood War and StarCraft 2. StarCraft 2 is much more convenient and more easy to use, I think.
Yeah, and that's not to say that the newer games are bad. It's just that there's a lot to the older games, or in the newer games, that we take for granted. And when you take somebody out of that environment and bring them to the older games before we had those conveniences, it really throws people for...
Yeah, things like selection limits or automatic inventory sorting, you know, all those things came in later games and aren't there in the original versions. So you spend a lot of time micromanaging and dealing with those things that are now automated.
Like saving the game, it's most of the games don't have a save game function anymore, and it's so baffling to me. Also, for Diablo 1, I have fond memories. Back in elementary school, we had the computer lab every Friday afternoon, and this was around 2000. The school's PCs were pieces of shit running Windows 95, and Diablo 1 was one of the only games we could play in LAN mode, and we did it all the time. Like the computers were at a place when they could run some games, but the games they could run mostly didn't have multiplayer. A very little subset of games you could actually play, because the newer games were requiring much stronger hardware, and the older games didn't have any LAN functionality. So Diablo 1 fit in that sweet spot, and imagine like 12-year-olds screaming every Friday afternoon about killing Diablo, and yeah, it was great. One of my fondest memories. Alright, let's get back to StarCraft a bit. So, Locutus, you were performing very well in the SSCIT finals. I must say congratulations, not just in the finals.
Thank you.
And for your whole performance. And currently you are the first on the SSCIT ladder, and congratulations to for that as well. Can you talk about what did you add, how did you modify your bot before the finals? Before this year's SSCIT, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it was really just adding a bit of tweakings for each matchup. So for PBT, it was adding the Seda killer, basically, the proxy DT rush, which is, I mean, it's the classic sniping, right? It was purely put in to beat Zeta. And for PvP, I did actually some work that kind of backfired on me because I was expecting one or more of the Locutus clones or Furcutuses or whatever we're calling it today to show up. So I did a bit of work on my kind of anti-Locutus clone stuff, which ended up making me more vulnerable to DT rushes, which did not work out very well in the finals. But yeah, that was that. And for PVZ, I did a bit of just reactive Corsairs against Mutalisks to basically just make sure Killerbot didn't surprise me. So it was kind of, I mean, the bot's pretty much been in the same state since AIID, and it was just showing up some weaknesses. And yeah, it performed pretty well.
Was it hard to watch just dying to the DTs?
Yeah, I mean, not because I was thinking any thoughts like I should have won or anything like that. I think Dan was definitely the appropriate winner. The depth in his bot is amazing. But I mean, obviously, I would have liked to make it a bit more competitive just so it wasn't the same thing every game.
You did good.
Also got second in AIST. Really good PvP play and almost got Velocity Random. I will also say, too, for SSCAIT, I watched a lot of PvP games with Dan, trying to work on counters for Locutus and the other Protoss bots, and it was not a trivial effort. There's a lot of time that was put into that.
Actually, that's the next topic I wanted to talk about, AIST and the results. Well, Antiga, please continue analyzing the players and this year's AIST.
There's a lot to be said about it. I mean, the real big surprise is, you know, Velocity Random is sort of a new recreation of an old bot that's rejoined this sort of competitive circuit and was able to win AIST. And I think most people would have thought that Velocity Random would have been, you know, sort of in the bottom tier of the bots that competed. And that ended up being very much so not the case. It got a pretty good seeding, where it was seeded into round two against Steamhammer, which is pretty favorable for it. But if you actually run it against the other bots, it had favorable win rates of 50% or better versus everyone in the field. Which is truly impressive. The amount of time that went into the exploits to make that happen, I don't even want to think about it. I would guess he had hundreds of hours into that to find those Kodamal and test them, you know, versus an entire field. It's really, really impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to watch most of the matches. Any really interesting happenings?
I think the McRae versus Purple Wave matches are really pretty jaw-dropping. Both of them made pretty large improvements to their bots, and we're seeing the first generation of high-quality Reaver Micro in PvP out of them, both of them, and being used actively in tournaments instead of just prototype demonstration stuff. And I recommend those games to anyone. They're an excellent watch, and they actually play twice, both in the upper bracket and in the loser's bracket, and both times it's an excellent series.
And there were a cash prize, actually. I'd like to stress this, that's presumably just your own money, but it's a very nice thing to do. It gives an incentive, not the amounts themselves, but just something to work for. And I admire that decision by a lot.
Yeah, and you know, I just put some of my own money into it. And I want to support especially the smaller developers. You know, some of the folks who compete are, you know, they're older and they do this as a hobby, and really the money doesn't matter, or they're doing it professionally. But some of the developers are, you know, high school or college kids, and a little bit of funding really goes a long way, so happy to help provide that, and I hope to increase that in future years. And I would be more than happy to accept donations towards the prize pool. If you donate to me, 100% of it will go towards the prize pool. So.
Yeah, and consider that not every developer lives in the USA or other high income areas. So even $25 can go a long way. And it's and it's more motivation than the actual amount. Speaking of that, question to everyone. Do you think some kind of monetization like this or similar schemes could benefit this community? I mean, would it incentivize more people to join? Of course, this is a difficult question, as we mentioned, developers are generally not paid poorly. But still, let's hear your thoughts.
Well, I would say that a cash prize, I mean, at least if we're getting into the area where it's something that's, you know, significant, then it's probably coming along with a lot more attention to the tournament. And just that, I think, would entice some more people into it. I mean, definitely, if we're talking younger developers, the money is one thing, but getting yourself out there and having something that you can kind of market yourself with is also very important.
Yeah, money associated with a tournament is usually, meaning sponsors are associated with the tournament. And like Lokita said, you know, that means more eyes are on it. So I don't think it's a bad thing for there to be some sort of money incentive attached to the tournaments. And it can certainly bring out the competitive spirit in people sometimes.
And also, you know, the amount of time that really takes, you know, preparation time that really goes in to be competitive enough to win some of the bot tournaments, you know, the prize money would have to be on the order of like $20,000 or $50,000 to really compensate people appropriately for what their program or their dev time would cost. And, you know, there's just not financing available at that scale at this point. But, you know, we would love to have sponsors if people are interested in sponsoring AI development.
And one of the things with the StarCraft scene too, I mean, as Antigua has hinted at, there's a lot more hours that go into it on that competitive level than just programming. You know, there you have to scout out your opponents and what they're doing. You have to know about StarCraft strategy or have somebody that knows about StarCraft strategy. And you have to theorycraft, essentially. You know, how are you going to counter what somebody might throw at you? And the bot meta is different from human meta today. So, you know, it's just being familiar with what humans are doing today doesn't necessarily help you in the bot circuit. So there's so many more hours that go into it, you know, just on that side of things.
Yeah, and Brood War has a 20-year advantage for that. I mean, there are literally people who have 20 years of continuous Brood War experience and have seen it all. And most likely, if you come up with a tactic in Brood War, someone has already countered it sometime. That's not necessarily true in 100% of the cases, but let's say 99. Antigua, I think you're kind of that person, right?
Yeah, sort of. I've been around it a really long time. I would say that, you know, people often ask me, like, they're like, oh, this bot made this new strategy. It's super inventive. And I'm like, well, you know, really, I see something truly unique as far as a build order out of a bot, maybe once every 6 months. And all the rest of it is stuff that I've ever either seen before in a bot or seen before in the human circuit if I dig back long enough into old games and old strategies. You know, really a lot of the bot strategies that I see played competitively were really designed 15 to 20 years ago. And while a lot of the human matches have moved beyond some of that, you still see some of those old plays occasionally. And the older StarCraft players have seen a lot, seen a lot of games and seen a lot of strategies over the years. So it really, a lot of it is not new. Some of the usage is really interesting. You know, of course, like Lakutus's Goon Micro sort of pressures the meta a lot, or Iron's Vultures, in a way that humans are not really used to.
And that's not to say that, you know, the bot scene is you know, so there's that far back in the human meta because it's so bad. It's more just as bot authors are getting better at controlling the game, just like humans were when StarCraft first started. You know, a lot of the meta was one base play. You know, you would see a game go where everybody just stayed on one base, and then slowly people started going, well, let me grab that second base, and then and there was another shift where people were like, well, what if I grab that second base like almost right away? And then eventually StarCraft morphed into this game where expansions are important and how many expansions you have versus your opponent, etc. And part of the driver was people just got better at controlling the units in the game and found that they could get away with a lot more things and cut a lot more corners and still survive. And something that I'm seeing in the bots are that a lot, especially in the competitive bots, the unit control is getting so much more precise and better. And also, you know, controlling where the army is going and what the army is doing is getting better. And as they're doing that, bot authors are finding, hey, I can get away with this and not die. And that's what pushes the meta forward in a game like this.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. And, you know, also, not, you know, while I'm talking about this older stuff, you know, at the same time, we're lifting build orders over them out of the most recent KSL and ASL seasons. And we're also watching Flash's YouTube videos and Best and lifting their prototypes that have never even seen competitive play yet and loading them into bots for testing. So, you know, it's a combination of really old stuff, and probably most of it is really old. But some of the bots that are really pushing the limits, you're seeing the brand new stuff that's not even a week old get loaded. So it's really pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I think something that will drive the bot meta a bit forward will be when a lot of bots start focusing on defensive skills more than offensive skills. Because some of the stuff that you need to be able to do greedy macro stuff, you need to have good worker defense, good defense in general. And I know my bot is mostly terrible at that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens the next little while with that.
And one thing that I'm still not really seeing from Terran bots, I think there is still like one bot that does it, is taking advantage of high ground with tanks for defensive positions, and taking your natural and things like that. I still don't see a Terran bot doing something like
that. Sada actually has a pre-programmed ramp edge position for tank holding, but it's one of the few, or maybe the only one. When you watch it in the overhead overlay, it has that for positioning, but maybe the only one that does.
And they don't use fire bats enough. That is the main problem, I think.
Fire bats are just useless. They're such a sad unit.
They're only useful in late game TVZ, really, when to be under swarm, and that's like a.
They are not useless. They are just misunderstood.
I'm really looking forward to the point when we have some of the big teams that have gotten so far with the machine learning StarCraft bots. That they actually hopefully start coming up with some new stuff. Because at least the way we have it designed right now, where you don't have any APM limits, there has to be some, like, it has to end up at some kind of a different equilibrium point as far as meta and balance and that kind of thing. So it'll be fun to see where that ends up.
It's interesting that you say that, because I heard the story that a pro player tried to beat your goons at Goon Micro, and he didn't. He couldn't do it. Like, your Goon Micro is better than at least one pro player. It's certainly possible that there are better human players, but not many. So, first of all, great work. Second, can you tell us about what your goons are actually doing?
What my goons are doing?
Yes.
All right, sure. The goons themselves, they just, they're doing frame perfect timing. So they shoot and then they move at the right frame. And what I do beyond just moving back from whatever's closest to it is do a bit of collision detection. So if I have a lot of goons together, then they'll kind of spread out a bit. And that's really all of the kind of close quarters micro it's doing. I think what's probably had more of an impact is tuning my combat sim so that I kind of fudge the results if I'm close to a choke point or fighting up a ramp or something like that. So I basically take the result from the combat sim and say, I don't really believe this because I'm fighting through a narrow choke. I'm going to assume that my units are going to do half the damage that the combat sim says and that they're going to do. So that's really improved quite a bit my performance against in like a PvP goon versus goon battle. It's really not really the specific unit micro that's doing it. It's more the not sticking my neck out too far when I shouldn't.
Trust no one, not even your combat sim.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is if you run my bot against itself in just like running 4-gate goon against 4-gate goon, it's usually the instance of the bot that attacks the furthest first that ends up losing.
That's actually something to think about. So a little bit more about competitions. My idea about competitions and monetizing the whole thing is just an idea, and I would like to hear your opinion on it. Is what if we had like hackathon type things, when you have a set time limit, 1 or 2 weeks maybe, to develop something, so you don't have to develop a perfect bot, but for example, make a bot that is best on this wacky map or something. So one by one, getting the bots to face a very specific subset of problems, and therefore just narrowing the research in that direction.
I think AINTT sort of fills that hole in some ways. You know, it's really sort of a fun term, but at its heart, it's a programming challenge. It's not really a competitive high-end bot challenge. It's a programming one, which I think is a good subset that we really need, is, you know, an aspect of it that's purely a developmental challenge.
Full disclosure, every time you say AITT, I just imagine a robot with metal boobs.
Oh no. we won't talk about all of our names for simulators and all that different stuff then. It's just gonna get rough.
Yeah, let's get back to the StarCraft hackathon.
I think it's almost a sport creating a library or a piece of software and naming it an inappropriate acronym has become a sport to itself.
I think we have Haynes to thank for that. Or rather, we have him to thank for starting that.
There's history in this, though. I think the team at LucasArts that did Maniac Mansion started naming all their stuff like bodily fluids or something like that, and it kind of also rolled into the point where they had to kind of say, you know what, maybe we should stop. So I think it's human nature.
It reminds me of I won't go into the full story, but the story that Day 9 tells, the day he almost died, if anyone has watched his old Day 9 dailies, when he talks about this educational math program that he had to write and show, and he talks about the code underneath it and how variable names just start to devolve very quickly when you're under pressure and tired.
Yeah, you take out your stress on the code. That happens. And I had witnessed multiple times a client facing some test string that shouldn't have seen the light of day. Like, I implemented this fucking function for the fucking client or something like that. Needless to say, there were business repercussions.
But back to your point, on maybe like a hackathon type thing, it might be interesting to see some push for tackling the other game modes in StarCraft, because while you know, one-on-one, or even to a much lesser extent, 2v2, which I think picked up more with StarCraft 2, you know, is the main focus. StarCraft Rood War has, like, capture the flag, a greed mode, a slaughter mode, that no one ever really pays any attention to. So it could be interesting, you know, to have a greed tournament. Who can make a bot that can mine the minerals the fastest against an opponent? Or even, you know, that could solve the question of this mineral locking, although I think it might even be solved, but does mineral locking really make you mine that much faster? As well as, you know, there could be micro challenges or things like that, like who can in 1 hour program goons that can take on Locutus's goons. But I think maybe one of the hard things to that, to having a time limit, I'm not exactly sure, I'm not familiar enough with hackathon events to know like how long people have to accomplish the goal. But in a game like StarCraft and with BW API, there's so many things you have to solve for if you're starting from scratch that, you know, it would be unrealistic, I think, to have a very strict time limit without allowing library usage.
Yeah, it's not easy, you know, and really there's, you know, a lot of people do this as a hobby, and hackathon type things are really something you go to an event, you spend 2 or 3 days there, and you do nothing else. And it's a lot of stress. I have thought about for bot tournaments, having it where, you know, we play round one, then everybody gets a few days to update their bot, then we play round two, and everybody gets a few days to update, and then we play round three, etc., right? But it puts a tremendous strain on the authors as far as personal time. That has made me sort of shy away from doing that, though I'm still considering something like that for in the future.
Yeah, I think that would, it would benefit authors that also have done a lot of work to get their bot as well-rounded as possible beforehand, because, you know, ideally you would then be able to just kind of look at how the other players are playing in the tournament and say, okay, I'm going to enable these builds instead and not have to do that much work. So, I mean, I think it could still work. I mean, going to the kind of more wacky ideas, if we do something like, you know, you have a week to make a bot that plays this weird map, then you're kind of also in the same situation that if the authors have a strong foundation already that they can build on top of, then it's probably realistic. Though, obviously, the people who have the most time to spend in that week are going to have an advantage.
You can't have it 100% fair, unfortunately. Like we said, the different time schedules, there will be always people who can't make it that time frame. That's okay. I think that that's just life. But to reflect to Antigua's point, yeah, physically getting together for a weekend, 2 or 3 days is not really feasible. Both developers are all around the world, mostly the USA and Europe, but all around the world, and you just can't feasibly organize that. So it have to be online. It have to be within the time limit, and it can't really be code a bot from scratch. That is not fun, and also just wrestling with the API is. It's not a challenge, it's just a drudge. And you should allow our existing bots to enter and just develop some new feature, like Venom Plasma. That would be a fun challenge.
It's hard. People really underestimate the amount of, you know, base systems that have nothing to do with competition that you have to build for Rood War bot to run properly. Things like the mining system, building buildings, scouting, being able to expand, having a production queue if you use one. You know, all those things are the underpinnings of the bot, and the quality of those makes a tremendous difference on the outcomes before you even get to what strategies should you use. You know, you've got, most people, you've got 2 or 3 months of just doing basic underlying systems before you even get to that point. And so it's a real struggle in a lot of ways to about this more competitive.
I mean, I built the Nightcat bot from scratch. I think I've integrated a few libraries since, and actually in the beginning I did integrate the terrain analysis, because that's just above my understanding of how to do that on my own. But and then eventually I added Haynes's combat simulator in as well. But you know, solving for how are you going to place your buildings, how are you going to position your army, where are you going to move your army to advance, you know, making sure that if the enemy keeps harassing your front line, your stray marine that wanders off or stray zealot doesn't get killed, you pull it back. But you know, you don't always want to pull it back, because maybe it's just one marine firing and you can kill it. There's so many things that you have to take care of just in the base starting point. And that's actually one reason, one thing that I did when I started working on my bot was I just designed it to play on Big Game Hunters, and actually its original name was BGH Bot, because then that just eliminated some of those things I had to worry about. I didn't have to worry about expanding, because BGH gives you unlimited minerals. Granted, you're more powerful even on that map if you expand, but just trying to eliminate some of the things that you have to get working off the ground to get a good bot going gave me some targets and made it a little bit easier to get going.
Okay, so speaking of developing and beginning with it and the woes of that, my favorite example is, I think it was on Jay Scott's blog, when he mentioned that he identified 17 different reasons why or how a building placement could fail. So there are 17 distinct cases you have to code for just to get a building placed 100% building build, and that is staggering. It is not the only problem of its kind, and a beginner developer might get discouraged seeing these kind of stuff, but that is what makes PWA API beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you also have to keep in mind that there's perfection, there's handling everything perfectly, and then there's doing enough to get by. And I would definitely recommend that anybody who's getting started just do like the minimum possible of each thing, and then move on and come back to it when it's the thing that's the most important to fix. And in that sense, I mean, for AITT, I'm pretty sure that all of the bots were using the built-in BW API building placer for at least the majority of their building placement. And they worked okay as far as that was concerned. I mean, they had much bigger issues than building placement. So yeah, just, I mean, kind of from a software engineering aspect, try to make sure to do it in an iterative process.
Yeah, and separate out the parts. Oh, sorry.
No problem. I was just going to say, to expand on that, you know, the building placement in the Nightcat bot has evolved, because it started off just kind of trying random locations in its space where it wants to build the building until it found one that BWAPI said, hey, you can build here. And then when that started becoming a problem for my bot, I then started to look into an improved model. I think there was a step I did in between, but then I ended up settling on something that actually looks a lot like the tool that McRave built, because at the same time we started talking about it, and the main difference between his and mine is that his does everything in advance and then mine does it as needed, where it's like, oh, I need a block of this size, I don't have any open blocks of this size, so let me find where I can place one now. But it was an iterative process, and like you said, Locutus, I didn't improve on it. I did something that was good enough to start, and then I improved on it when it was a problem for my bot.
There is an idiom in software engineering that perfect is the enemy of good, and it is very much applies here.
Yeah, and it's important to keep in mind that, for instance, just with your mining system, you know, when you start it, you're going to have version 1, which would be really simple, but 3 years down the road, you're going to be on version 15. And so it's good to have the modules sort of be set up in such a way that you can upgrade them and do versions of them without rewriting your whole bot, and sort of have them separated out as in, subsystems in at least some sort of logical fashion.
So, speaking of beginning AI development, I hope you listened to the last cast. I think it was a very good one with Fear Dragon, who is a StarCraft 2 caster and beginner of Brood War API, Brood War AI programming. I'm very curious what he will accomplish, because I think getting new people into this hobby is very important, and as people leave, new blood must be sacrificed, and I hope there will be a follow-up on that. And everyone who wants to do something similar, just please contact me, because I'm really curious about people who are just beginning this. Of course.
Yeah, it was really fun to listen to as well. So I hope that he does start making a bot and comes back to with a whole new round of questions. I'm sure he'll have 10 times as many questions once he's spent 10 or 20 hours.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of that, helping each other, BW API is getting the 4.3 version. At least I've seen people working on it, so that's great. And I don't know what's the status on that, and I don't want to spread falsehoods here, but it is worked upon. And other than that, I saw increased activity in some library developments and also updating the Liquidpedia page of bots. It is my feeling that in the last few weeks, some collaboration has started, or rather intensified in this community, and I find this a welcome development. Do you feel the same, or could something be the cause of this, or this is just a upswing for no reason?
So about BW API, I'm not on the development team for that, but I sort of track it pretty actively. And they had 4.3, but it had some internal bugs. And there was a very quick move to 4.4. Some differences between client bots, etc., caused that. And there's also some additional fixes in 4.4. And 4.4 seems to be pretty stable, from what I understand. And I expect that 4.4 will become a tournament-supported build. And I understand that Bazel already supports it. And that 4.3 is probably will not be used due to the bugs that were found on release.
I was just thinking on the versioning, the numbers, why they decided to go from 4.3 to 4.4 instead of like 4.3.1 with the fixes. I guess the fixes were large enough that it warranted that 4.4.
Yeah, we
did discuss it a bit, but there were a few more fixes in it, so yeah, I guess that would warrant the version. I mean, the weird thing is you have a version that basically can't be used because there are problems with it. But I mean, it's just a version number at the end of the day, and we'll all forget about it and move on, I think.
And last topic for today, this is actually inspired by a conversation with Locutus. I hope you don't mind discussing private conversations. So it's how do you organize your bot development time? It's a bigger issue than most people would think. I myself just try to do it every day, like 20 minutes or so, and work on my bot. But with work and kids and family, it's getting hard. What's your method for actually achieving some progress on your bot?
Yeah, well, I guess bot development is pretty much just taken over all of the me time I had in my life, right? I've pretty much stopped playing any games myself, and just, you know, would rather program something to play games instead, I guess. It's more fun. But yeah, it's basically, yeah, whenever I have 20 or 30 minutes, just kind of throw myself into it. And if I have a free night for whatever reason, then I'll be able to, you know, spend a couple of solid hours and maybe work on something that's a bit more in depth, that requires a bit more focus. And luckily, where I live, the work-life balance is pretty good, so I'm not going through periods where I get worked to death. So I'm usually pretty, kind of, I don't know, ready to work on the bot when I have time for it. So it's, it's a hobby, and it will never be more than that, and that's fine with me.
You mentioned you work in the mornings from 6 to 7.
Yeah, having kids kind of turned me into a morning person, and now that they're actually sleeping a bit longer, if I wake up early, I'll just get up and spend a bit of time on the bot before everybody else wakes.
That's just insane.
Yeah, I know when I first jumped into this and started it, I think like almost all of my free time was being sunk into the project, and really that's just the way that I've handled it. When I have some free time, I could be like, well, hey, I could play a game, I could watch a show, or I could program. And I think depending on what you're doing for your job, really decides on if that's an easy decision to make or not. If you're professionally a programmer and you're doing that for 8 hours a day or more, and then you come home, you might not find programming to be something that helps you unwind. Whereas, while my job is a technical job, it's not technically as a programmer. So to me, still, programming a bot to play a game for me is just as fun as playing the game itself. So that's kind of the way that I've done it, is, you know, my game time had become my programming time.
That's basically what happened to me. I don't really play video games anymore, only when I'm like that tired and can't do anything meaningful, but somehow programming has become more fun. And I'm a professional software developer by day, but I find that for most software developers, when they don't want to do more of their job, it's not because of the coding they must do. It's usually other factors that turn people off for software from software development. That's not saying that I don't want to badmouth my job. Don't take it that way. I'm not speaking about my job. It's a different kind of stuff. It's something I don't get to do professionally, and that's why I enjoy it. And after all day staring at bad screen at work, I just came home and stared at good screen for 4 more hours. That's great.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same way. At work, it's a completely different atmosphere, and you're usually not spending most of your time just, you know, doing raw coding, at least at a level that requires a lot of thinking. It's mostly figuring out how everything should be tied together and then doing something that you've probably done something similar to 50 times before, something like that. And for me, I also wanted to do my bot in C++ because it's kind of a different mind space for me, right? It's in some ways more of a challenge, in some ways just different enough that it kind of keeps things fresh. I would just say we mentioned AITT earlier in the cast, but just to kind of give an early reminder, the map pool has been decided and the bot size limit of 4 kilobytes has been decided now. So anybody who's interested in that, go into the AITT channel on the Discord or hit up McRae's website and take a look at it. It'll be fun to see what we come up with this year. And it's island maps this time, so all kinds of weird strategies might be seen this time.
And try not to think about robot poops.
Well, I'll be excited what they come up with for that tournament. It's really fun to see. You know, it's sort of a proving ground for StarCraft AI developers, and it's really fun to see what people come up with in a short span of time, and the creativity that they go into to compress their bot is really sort of a unique aspect of it. You don't get a lot of space, so you really gotta keep things going. I will say with AIST, we've got the versus human matches that'll probably come out in a week or two for the public. They're scheduled right now to be played on the 13th of this month, so Velocirandom's only got 3 more days to prepare.
Yeah, AITT is a very great coding challenge. I support it wholeheartedly. All right, then. Thank you very much for being here, and I hopefully see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Bye.